Let's find a conversation to your soul. Let's conversation to your soul and the night.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here alone because I allowed Derek to take the day off, but I'm really actually excited about this episode. I'm welcoming my actual friend, Andrew DeWard. Andrew is an assistant professor of media and popular culture at the University of California, San Diego, down there in La Jolla. He's literal neighbors with Mitt Romney, and he's also the author of Derivative Media, How Wall Street Devours Culture. So Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here.
So we're going to talk about you going through the Romney's trash. Why? No, just kidding. Let's start talking about this book you have, Derivative Media, which to my mind is the most important book written on the media that I've come across in the last year or so, having written my Harper's piece, which is actually how I got to know you, Andrew. So we're going to talk a lot about the media and monopoly and all the financial instruments that go into shaping modern Hollywood. But before we do, I wanted to ask you a question about the falling rate of profit, because I think the falling rate of profit, or that idea, is really structuring your book, and it structures a lot of our own lives when it comes to our experience in capitalism. So Andrew, could you explain what you understand to be the falling rate of profit, what that means, and then we could go into how this shapes the actual media?
Yes, thank you. What I think a lot of scholars and analysts about Hollywood and the media industries miss is that broader history of capitalism and how it informs what's going on today. So for historians like Braudel and Arrighi, the falling rate of profit and financialization is something that reoccurs every time the world system's capitalist hegemon reaches maturity, once it enters into crisis. It happened with the Genoese, it happened with the Dutch, happened with the British, and now it's happening with the American Empire. So there's this great quote Braudel has, every capitalist development of this order seems, by reaching the stage of financial expansion, to have in some sense announced its maturity. It is a sign of autumn. And so that's a big influence on my book, and I think a key way to understand the media industries today within a context of decline, within falling rate of profit, what kind of investments get made, what kind of extractive techniques get made, what kind of financial engineering strategies occur. And so in my book, kind of cataloging all the different types, hedge funds, asset managers, private equity, venture capital, stock buybacks, et cetera. All of this can only take place if opportunities for profit have disappeared, traditional opportunities, let's say.
And just to clarify, the idea is that as time moves on and these states consolidate and the private corporations that operate within them consolidate, is that there are fewer places to actually invest and learn and earn large returns. So in order to basically keep a level of the large return coming in, what companies have to do is resort to new financial strategies. And so the argument, as I understand it, is that since the 70s, this has happened in the United States. And so you have the rise of novel financial instruments, largely, though not totally, due to deregulation, like the increased use of dividends, the increased use of stock buybacks, the rise of things that used to be illegal, like wolf packs and hedge funds and things along those lines. And what Andrew is saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that these are, in effect, artifacts of the fact that it is more difficult to make incredibly large returns on capital investment. And to my mind, and something that I came away with from reading your work, is that this helps explain Hollywood in the sense that the larger question is, why are all of these companies actually investing in Hollywood? Why are these new financial instruments being used in Hollywood? Why did private equity, why did hedge funds, why did the three asset management firms become interested in Hollywood? And the answer is that there's not many other places to invest, because Hollywood is notoriously and Andrew, correct me when I'm done with this gloss if it's wrong, but Hollywood is notoriously not a great business. As William Goldman, the famous screenwriter, said, nobody knows anything. So it's almost the exact opposite of the reliable, stable return that a financial company would traditionally want to receive on their investment. So in effect, the very fact that so many of these companies are in Hollywood suggests something larger about the history of capitalism, and in particular, the history of American capitalism. Is that correct?
Yes, and the great overview. I'll give maybe a few clarifying points. I think your suggestion that deregulation is an artifact is absolutely crucial and missed so often, right? And I will just say, yeah, even neoliberalism more generally, or deregulation, often thought of as the cause of so many of our problems rather than in effect, a symptom of a much deeper rot, which is the crisis in capitalism, the crisis of generating profit. So the deregulation was bound to happen as capitalism needed more opportunities. So, you know, we can't wish this away. We can't vote it away. Those things might help, but they are certainly not going to cause or fix that problem. So, yeah. And then, as you mentioned, you jokingly about Mitt Romney, yeah, you have Bain Capital all of a sudden being interested in starting with music. They buy out what was then Clear Channel, is now iHeartMedia, and some others, you know, private equity companies getting involved in this industry that, yeah, has been historically pretty difficult. I would clarify to say, well, there have been some big companies that have managed to do quite well for quite a long time. So it depends on who you are. And that maybe things are getting a little more streamlined, a little more controlled, and thus companies can come in and sort of extract that profit in a way that was difficult in the 90s. Yeah, so many banks, investment companies tried and failed to make money from blockbusters, let's say. But now when so much of our consumption patterns are surveilled and tracked through big tech firms, they actually have, you know, a lot more control over that system. So I think that actually lines up pretty well with, you know, the pretty big extractive surge that's happened in the last 10, 20 years that I document.
So the first chapter of your book is called, it's basically a snapshot of the current American political economy. So why don't we go through that again, just to give a sort of structuring understanding to listeners, where exactly, what does capitalism actually look like in the mid-2020s? And then we'll go back to the story to talk about how music and film and television have become financialized. But what is the current state of the U.S. political economy?
Yeah, this was a silly task I gave myself. Just that, you know, one of those book writing things. Well, we can't understand hedge funds unless we do this. We can't understand asset management unless we go back, right? And so I try to give as many sort of charts, for one thing, and orienting pieces of the political economy. Of course, it is not comprehensive, but I really walk through that sort of disagreement over, yeah, neoliberalism versus capitalism more generally, and trying to look at the declining rate of profit, the recurrence and rise of financial capital. And, you know, we have things like the dramatic decrease in tax rates for the wealthy occurring over from the 60s on, the rise of tax havens, the rise of political lobbying, which has just gotten out of control in the last election. But, you know, you can chart as this sort of one of many slow declines or rises, right? So the decline of GDP growth, the decline of tax rates, the decline of the rate of profit, the decline of tax rates, you then get the rise of finance, lobbying, different forms of debt. And so all of these things are mirrored in the cultural industries as well. And then they come to what is an essential period after the dot-com crash. You have this huge, you know, frothy, as they would say, financial market leading to the financial crash. And then afterwards, you have the, you know, so-called ZIRP, this zero interest rate period. And this is when things get really dicey within the media industries. A lot of predatory financial extraction. So it's this, yeah, the longest bull market in U.S. history ends because of COVID-19. But we haven't actually dropped that fixation on getting interest rates back to zero, getting that liquidity back in the market, and thus this sort of dump trucks full of money for companies to practice new techniques, things like Uber, Airbnb, Netflix, Spotify, right? They can't exist unless they have that tremendous liquidity and the ability to, you know, run roughshod over labor regulations. And so this is very much a Hollywood and music industry story, as well as a big tech story.
And so just to make it clear for people who might not be specialists, is what zero interest rates do is they effectively pump money into these companies. It makes it much easier and cheaper to borrow money that they can then use to do things like acquire other companies. Disney famously, of course, acquiring Marvel and Lucasfilm, and even before the dot-com crash, Pixar. So that is what it does, basically, right? It pumps money into the system, and in a system that, due to deregulation, is dominated by gigantic conglomerates like the media companies, but not just the media companies, you know, the proverbial shine hard wigs from 30 Rock, these companies could then use that money to purchase other smaller companies, effectively becoming not only monopolies in their own industries, but monopolies in multiple industries. Is that correct?
Yeah. And in the media, we have a long history of this. Like I said, you know, so the biggest studios have been around for a century, but we do have this increased drive towards consolidation, and just openly stated as such by big media moguls. And it's important to realize, as you say, in the 80s and 90s, the entertainment companies become, yeah, not just film companies, entertainment companies. They have film, TV, cable TV, music, news, everything, right? It is these ever-growing behemoths that, for a long time, regulation said you can only operate in one market. You know, you're not allowed to move into these others. As that fell away, we have these huge entertainment conglomerates. But then once you have the rise of big tech firms who are going to use media as a way to get you using their phone, get you using Amazon Prime, you know, film and TV and music are just something that we're constantly using on our devices. And so it was a good way to sort of earn that loyalty, a lost leader, as they say. You know, Amazon probably doesn't make very much money, if any, from Amazon Music, but it gets a lot of...
I would be shocked if it made money from any of its entertainment properties. I just don't see, given the output and given the... I just don't see how they possibly make money.
Right. Certainly something like Lord of the Rings, which is a cost... I guess I was reading... I mean, it cost like $250 million just to get the rights, and then it was $300 million for one season. Like over a billion.
They purchased an era of history. It's actually pretty interesting. Like, you could write a dissertation on this. What they did, they didn't purchase the rights to Lord of the Rings. They purchased an era of its history.
Right. And so they had to, the main story.
They purchased the Second Age. Like, the entirety of the Second Age, if my understanding, is owned by Amazon, which means that they could set stories in the Second Age, but I'm not sure that they could reference certain characters, or they mm-hmm. can't, like, mess with the canon. So it's actually kind of an interesting intellectual property thing that they purchased literal historical, fake historical, but historical time. Right. But I mean, given that amount of money, I just can't imagine that they're making much off of it.
Right. So, but what they are getting is lots of consumption, usage on their devices, data about consumption, and Amazon is yet, you know, slowly growing this empire. And now, so consolidation is not new, but it is being driven
steroidal.
To further extremes.
Steroidal. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like asymptotic. It's like approaching the asymptote, you know, exponentially, right, is how I think about it.
And I write about that can only happen with financialization, that financialization fuels this kind of consolidation. You have companies or examples where a private equity comes in and just like destroys a company, does not know what it's doing. The most famous one in media industries is that a UK private equity firm called Terra Firma buys EMI, just has no idea how the music industry runs, which is, yeah, pretty complicated. They fire all kinds of musicians and staff. It goes terribly. Their creditor has to take the company back, has to get Citibank. And then, yeah, it gets split up and sold for parts. And so Universal gets bigger and Sony Music gets bigger. And this is a, you know, paradigmatic example of finance just fueling consolidation and also, you know, suppressing labor at the same time. Every example of private equity involves tremendous layoffs, eliminating pensions, eliminating unions, saddling a company with debt, all these kind of destructive tendencies. And I document over 40 cases of private equity in media industries in the last 25 years. It's a really under-acknowledged aspect of why film, TV, and music is in such a sad state today.
Thank you. Let's get specific. Let's talk about music, because you and I remember when CDs cost $20, and now we pay that or less to get access to all the music in history, or at least the music that has signed up with Spotify or Apple Music or whatever. So, Andrew, how the fuck did that happen? tell us the story of the financialization of music, which to me is it's not the most interesting. I'm more interested in film and TV, but it's the most paradigmatic almost. It's that music was totally destroyed. You know, I have family that had pretty good lives working in the music business in the 90s, and just things totally came apart for them. And they were on the capital side of the, they were on the business side of the equation. So how did this happen? What happened to music that basically makes it not a career, whether you're on the business side or the talent side?
Yes, it's a sad story. On one hand, you know, music will never die. But on the other hand, if only Taylor
That's
Swift...
That's actually our show slogan, dude. Music will never die. Fucking, we say that all the time. Beautiful. Right.
But only Taylor Swift or Drake and a few others seem to be able to actually make a living from it. There's many factors. And I would say, again, I'll mention that private equity, Bain Capital, not just buying Clear Channel, but they bought out Warner Music Group as well, right? One of the big labels. And so private equity is a big part of it. The transition to digital is often stated as the big downfall, right? That Napster comes out, no one wants to pay for music. Well, actually what happens is music transfers to a digital format. People love to share music because music is great. And there are so many, the music industry had been so consolidated at that time, it's unwilling to shift to this new consumption pattern, right? And there, yeah, we're high on the crazy CD prices. It had never been more profitable in the 90s, the recorded music industries, right? And so they're kind of asleep at the wheel. This thing happens and they go through this drought in the early aughts before they can, you know, they're sort of pushed by Apple and the iTunes store and then eventually these new streaming models. But important to note, during that whole time, those big record companies are just consolidating more and more. So yeah, they had some dry years, but they're actually far more profitable now. And which is reminding me that we we might often say, oh, these companies are really profitable, even though we had said earlier the rate of profit is falling, right? You can be in an overall climate of declining profit and still have very profitable companies.
Could we actually pause on that for a second? Two things that I want to point out. One, this all happens in the wake of massive deregulation of the 80s and the 90s. And we don't have time to get into the details of that. But I would point people when it comes to film and TV, Jennifer Holt's work. And Andrew, you know, I didn't focus on music for my piece. So you could say who they could focus on when it comes to the music side of the equation. But so there's massive deregulation, which allows more corporate consolidation over time. And then I wanted to ask this question because I was on Glenn Lowry's Profit and Profit. I was on Glenn Lowry's podcast, which I do believe probably runs a tidy profit. And we were talking about capitalism because we were talking about the election. And I'm like, you know, Glenn, I think it's all kind of a paper tiger. You know, it's all these market capitalizations are ridiculous. They're far exceed any profits. And he's like, yeah, but Daniel, they're super profitable. Like these companies are making money. So could you actually pause and talk about that criticism of Glenn Lowry? I mean, I think you and I would say, well, it's kind of just fake, but could you explain that fakeness for people and then we'll return to what happened specifically in music?
Sure. Yeah. The difference between the valuation of a company and its revenues is really essential and often overlooked. I think the best example is Disney and Netflix have very comparable valuations in the hundreds of billions of dollars. It varies depending on, you know, what's going on. Disney's obviously dipped huge during the pandemic while Netflix's went up, and then Netflix had a big correction. Anyway, the point being, revenues of Netflix are way smaller than Disney. Disney has this like sprawling global empire of theme parks, particularly merchandising, along with all its film, TV properties. Netflix does a good business, and it is, you know, slowly went global and created this, you know.
They're the only successful streamer. I mean, like, flat out successful streamer right now. They succeeded in becoming the equivalent to TV, kind of.
Potentially, yes. But still, revenue-wise, nowhere near Disney. And in part, this is that zero interest rate period, right? People, investors are seeing, oh, Netflix found the new model. They are going to be the next Disney. So let's pump money into it. And that stock price gets higher and higher to a degree that it is far outweighs its earnings. And so its actual return for investment is small if you were to buy that stock today compared to something like Disney. And so, yeah, like overvaluation is a real concern. I actually just saw a Financial Times article this morning that was like, America, so overvalued. So it's these huge companies now have such a huge part on the global stock market. There's no way that that can be sustainable in the long term. Now, so we have this difference between, yeah, revenues and valuation. So something like Spotify is another example of that. It is actually a really tough business. If you're Spotify, you are, on one hand, 70% of your revenue goes right back out the back door to the rights holders of the music, which is Universal, Warner, and Sony. Been around forever, really consolidated the copyright marketplace. And you're Spotify, and yet you can't, like you said, you've promised people they just get access to everything for their monthly fee. They're slowly trying to ratchet it up, but it's a really, once you've made that promise, unlike in film and TV, where people do not expect to just get the entire history of film and TV through one monthly payment. You can have something like Spotify, which has this huge valuation, seems to be the future, but is actually a really risky business. Other streaming music services have, of course, fallen away. Spotify's competitors are Amazon and Apple. I don't know how they continue in the shadow of those firms. But yeah, when we talk about making profits, sometimes it's actually pretty, what's the word? You know, non-sustainable, just because they've gotten so big so fast from a bunch of easy cash does not make it a long-term business.
So, Andrew, I have a question. So basically, are we saying that there's a difference between the quote-unquote real economy of how much these companies actually earn and their valuations on the market, on the stock market, literally, so that the problem being is that if they're never able to reach the heights of their market capitalization or even come close to them, eventually investors will get wise in theory, stop investing in them, and there will be a stock market crash. What is the fear here?
Yeah, I guess that's referring to something a little broader than just the media company market, let's say.
Right.
But yeah, certainly.
We're talking to Amazon. It's reflective. The media is reflective. Maybe you could explain that as well. Yeah.
Right. So you have these tremendously overvalued companies. On one hand, it seems unsustainable that they could maintain that valuation unless they continue to exercise such intense growth and monopolization and control. If Amazon keeps up eating companies, then maybe it can continue. But it's been hundreds of companies, right? I don't know that Google and Amazon can continue that sort of path. But for music companies, I think the fear is you keep pushing the bar lower and lower, right? So, you know, the reason why I go back to this history of radio with Clear Channel and whatnot is radio is really like setting the bar at literally nothing. In other countries, if you get played on the radio, you get paid. In the US, they just don't do that. So that's zero. And then
fucking
the next
great country. I love this country.
And then next you have YouTube, another tremendously exploitative service that says, look, people are going to upload your music onto our service. You can either let us put ads beside it and we will give you even less than Spotify, like fractions of a fraction of a fraction of a penny. Or you can file a claim every time you find a song of yours uploaded. And so that means you just spend hours of your day being like, here's a link to another of my songs, right? Hundreds, thousands, even listings of your song, right? They just made it impossible for you to fight that off. Famously, Prince, you know, paid someone to try to do that. He's like, no way am I putting my music on YouTube. There's a man who knew the value of music, right? But so you have YouTube setting the bar slightly above free. And then you have Spotify, who, like you said, yeah, offer everything for a low monthly fee or actually free, right? If you're willing to listen to some ads. And so you just keep pushing the bar down. Meanwhile, investors are looking at your company saying, oh, wow, Spotify, look at its growth. Look at its subscriber numbers. It's gone around the world, hundreds of millions. Let's keep bumping up its value. And so those two things can't really keep going in opposite directions. And I think film and TV is similar, right? Like peak TV just couldn't keep happening. You can't make more and more TV shows while people are actually unsubscribing from their cable TV bills, which were like north of $100, trading them in for Netflix, which is like $10, $15. And Netflix like helped destroy a really sustainable business model between windowing movies and cable TV. Film and TV had this like great long-term process where you put something in a theater, it goes to pay TV, it goes to, you know, all these windows or television. You can market it or you can go into syndication, you can sell it into all these different territories. Netflix is like, no, one thing, we're going to pay up front, we're going to take the global rights, and you get no back-end participation. And that's it. That like set the bar so low that like in the long term, it seems like these businesses can't work unless there's just a couple left. And that does seem to be the route we're heading.
Right now in Hollywood, there's basically four companies that are dominant. But before we get to that, let's turn back to music and tell us, how did that story proceed over the course of the 2000s and 2010s?
Yeah, sorry, I'm telling this very like non-linear story of music.
You're doing the weave. You're doing the Trump weave. Yeah, this right. is the era of the weave, baby. Enjoy it. Our listeners love it.
So we'll bring back a weave from 1994, the Telecom Act, deregulating media ownership. And that's what really, crushed radio.
Wait, you mean the 96 Act, the Telecommunications
Act? Sorry, 96,
yes. Yeah, okay, yeah.
And it had a lot of deregulatory outcomes for media, but radio was the one where like, oh, you can own lots of different radio stations. And so that's why it becomes so homogenized, so geared towards top 40 hits, so monotonous, so boring, right? You're just, instead of having lots of individual shows, you're just syndicating big ones. And so, yeah, you move from that early consolidation through the digital transition in which you consolidate more of the record companies. And then you have private equity all at the same time, you know, sort of harvesting. You also have venture capital, which a lot of folks think of in terms of, you know, Silicon Valley. You have these VC firms trying to pick out the new startups. In fact, corporate venture capital is a big part of the media industries. That's when a big firm has its own corporate venture capital arm. And so, you know, NBC, Universal, owned by Comcast. There's Comcast Ventures. There's a whole bunch, actually, and they're making hundreds of investments. And so the music industry is sort of saddled with these big companies that anything new that happens in music is quickly bought out by one of the companies that already has a huge stake in it. And they did the same thing to Spotify. In fact, Universal, Sony, and Warner each have a huge stake in Spotify. And so like when you try to think like, well, how did that happen? How did they devalue music so much? Well, if you are Universal Music and you have this new competitor, Spotify, rather than try to create your own streaming service, which they actually did, but it failed when the music companies tried to do it themselves. Think, well, why don't I just take a 10% stake in that company? And the earnings I make off that investment, I don't have to share with musicians in the way that I do when I, you know, work with them, license out their music different ways. And so, yeah, they are a venture capital fund, and they will make money from the earnings on their investments. And yeah, I track hundreds and hundreds of investments being made by all the big media companies have venture capital firms. So yeah, you know, how did that happen? Well, Spotify was incentivized by the very recording companies to pay less to their musicians because the owners, the big record companies actually were profiting from that investment.
Right, because they own part of Spotify. So there's like way, even breaking like the next Nirvana does not come close to what you would get by owning part of Spotify. Or if you're a corporate venture capital, owning part of Uber, you know, or whatever it may be, right?
So they did own a stake in Uber. Yeah, the Comcast Ventures did, I believe. Here I'm just looking up the actual statistics. The big three labels extracted 18% stock equity in Spotify, which is now worth about $12 billion to the labels. So they've been selling some of it. They don't have to share that. And then you have increasingly these other investment firms. They're called song management firms that are these boutique investment companies buying up as much copyright as they can.
Publishing rights, I imagine, right?
Publishing rights, yeah. Sometimes recording rights, but mostly publishing. But you hear, Neil Young even sold his rights. So many big stars have sold their rights. And so they're then being sort of compiled or aggregated by these investment firms. And
they're getting some money. The big ones get some money because they get some share in that pie. Probably a naive question. Why couldn't the artists fight back?
So in fact, musicians are not legally allowed to create their own union. Some version of it would be a cartel if musicians got together. Meanwhile, on the other side, Warner, Universal, and Sony act together in all kinds of ways constantly, right? Like they negotiated this stake with Spotify.
Well, the company should be unionized. What's the problem with that? It's just the people right. shouldn't be allowed to be.
Exactly. And so that's a big reason why they haven't been able to fight back. In the past, I think, you know, there was at least a certain middle class of musicians and a certain pathway to success that prevented too much outrage. I don't know. To be honest, it's never been great in the music industry. It's always been very difficult to make a living. It's just very pronounced now because of the way Spotify and YouTube have sort of completely obliterated recorded music as a revenue stream. Unless you are a superstar. I mean, and then the other side, and what was the excuse for so long was, okay, you have to give up your recorded music radio would say, well, we're good advertisement for you. We're promotion. You make the music on the live music circuit. Now you have Live Nation that owns Ticketmaster and a crazy monopoly on that. If you're a musician that wants to reach a sizable audience, you're going to have to deal with Live Nation, who are going to add all these fees, who are going to extract so much from you, who are going to prevent you from, you know, touring in the way that you want to. Meanwhile, the CEO of Live Nation has one of the biggest CEO to worker pay gaps of any Fortune 500 executive. I'm just looking it up. It is 5,400 times as much as his firm's median pay. This guy, Michael Rapino, making hundreds of millions of dollars, right? Similarly, the Daniel Ek, the guy of Spotify, one of the co-founders, you know, has $4 billion, his stake in that, right? So there's just tremendous inequality that's far more pronounced now than it was in the past. You know, the CEO of EMI or Capitol Records in the past would have never had this intense or this extreme of a disparity. And it's also I think one of the reasons why it's so enraging today is that it could so easily be a sustainable system. You have Spotify raking in a lot of revenue from these monthly streams. It could just be allocating wages to its tens of thousands of musicians Instead, it's giving huge paychecks to Drake and Taylor Swift and the CEOs and investors, and leaving the middle class and working class of musicians with nothing. It's like a really obvious case of why we need to allocate resources in a more sustainable way. It would actually be really easy to automate through Spotify that, you know, every musician who reaches a certain level gets a living wage. And that should come out of the investor side of things. It should come out of stock buybacks, which are just an insane waste of resources, right? If you're unfamiliar with stock buybacks, it's when a company buys its own stock. It seems really obvious. It doesn't seem too dangerous. It's like a dividend, right? It seems really benign. Oh, a company is sort of returning money to its investors. Well, when you buy back stock, what you are then not doing is investing in your workforce, investing in A&R in the case of music, and you know, research or innovation, and you are just putting money back into investors who are disproportionately already wealthy. So, yeah, stock buybacks—it's an insane number. I can look it up. I tallied up between for the last 20 years how many buybacks occurred through media companies. And it was, $320 billion, which, to put it lightly, could have financed a lot of musicians, songs, creative production. Specifically, it could have given a living wage to 1.7 million musicians to make music for 5 years, right? Instead, we're giving it back to investors. We're giving it to these ghouls like Daniel Ek and Michael Rapino, who are just extracting money off the backs of working musicians.
Let's move now to filmed entertainment, particularly scripted entertainment. How did this story proceed in film and TV? Because I think we could probably connect them because they're similar processes, and you could take them apart when necessary, but what happened there?
Yes. Similarly, you know, we have the increasing extractive processes of finance in music. I think I talk about it first in the book because it happens there first, starting in the 90s, and then certainly in the 2000s. And then if we were to compare other formats, we would say that news, right, journalism, is being decimated by particularly hedge funds, but finance in general. Film and TV, you know, a far more profitable business, very capital intensive. It sort of took longer. It's surviving, but it's also under attack in many ways. So we can look at the same sort of characters, private equity firms, which have bought out, MGM, DreamWorks, the big talent agencies, the trade press, lots of theaters, AMC and Regal. They've all gone through private equity at some stage. We can talk about hedge funds, venture capital. Something we haven't mentioned is asset managers. So asset managers are these big companies that manage finances for people for the most part. Like any investment company, they do all kinds of different things. They'll do real estate. They'll do private equity. But asset management are known for being big firms.
What are the big three? People have heard of them. Vanguard.
Yeah. BlackRock and State Street. Fidelity as the fourth one. Some company like BlackRock owns $10 trillion under management, right? This ungodly sum of cash. It's not theirs. They are managing it for investors, but that includes pensions, endowments. So many folks are trusting their money with these companies. And in part, it is because Vanguard in particular created the index fund. And then there are, what's the other one? Exchange traded funds. Yeah. ETS, sorry. And they allow for a pension or an individual investor, sort of like to invest in a large index. I'll invest in the S&P 500, all the big 500 companies, sort of like a mutual fund, except the fees are so much lower. on index funds and ETFs. And so these huge organizations, they are pooling capital, managing assets on others' behalf. They've gone from owning about 7% of the U.S. stock market in 1950 to nearly 70% today. And the biggest problem, or the two big problems with this, which is that they often own stakes in rival companies within a concentrated industry. So in media, for instance, in Hollywood, those four big companies you mentioned, but all the other medium-sized companies as well, they all have like 7, 8, 9% stake from BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, Fidelity. And you add that up, and about 20% of every company is owned by this, you know, block of asset managers. And so they call this horizontal shareholding or common ownership. And so, yeah, like, why compete when you're basically owned by these same firms? Now,
so Andrew, I do have a question. So it's the difficulty here is that it's difficult to point to a clear causal thing. You don't have someone at Vanguard talking to someone at Comcast and WBD telling them what to do, or do you? Like, what is the mechanism of influence here? Because it's difficult to like realize with a private equity firm or a hedge fund, it's clear you have a distinct group of people. They invest their money and they basically tell people how to run their company, and they do particular things. The asset manager firms, it's much more difficult to draw a clear line. Or tell me I'm wrong.
So first of all, in some cases, yes, they will have direct relationships. Now, someone far down the chain, like most media companies, probably not. BlackRock, yeah, $10 trillion. You're not going to bother with the smaller companies. But there have been cases of sort of direct relationships, but more sort of noteworthy and potentially more insidious is that it's just aligning incentives together between the ruling class, right? So investors, CEOs, particularly this like crazy executive compensation rate thing is aligning the incentives of asset managers and whoever's running a company. So first off, we could say, a huge change that a direct causal thing is that asset managers now have the voting rights of what used to be held by individual investors. So back in the 30s, 40s, stock markets, you know, over 90% individual investors, and they can exercise those voting rights if they want. So you can have like, you could shape a company by getting investors, you know, going to the shareholders meeting and saying, let's vote to lower executive compensation. That used to happen, sometimes still does. But now if you try to do that, you have Vanguard and BlackRock and State Street who own the voting rights of the people who are investing through them. And so they have these huge blocks of voting power, right? And so, yeah, someone wants to lower executive compensation rates. They're like, I don't think so. And it is particularly pronounced when it comes to climate measures, right? There have been intense pressure campaigns trying to get companies to be better about climate change, and BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street have almost unanimously voted those measures down because it doesn't serve their interests, which is just pure profit, to go along with things like that. So it's the voting rights that is certainly helping manage or align those incentives. You're right, though. There's no person from BlackRock breathing down the neck of a writer shaping what stories are being told. But that climate of what is expected from companies, what's going to be greenlit, what's going to be the new revenue stream is definitely influenced by asset management companies who have, you know, certain incentives, certain disincentives for competition. If you own a huge chunk of all the four big media companies, far more likely to do joint ventures than you are to like lower prices and compete or raise wages and try to compete over talent. It's like an overall climate of pushing down costs and increasing joint ventures.
So let's get in. How did this affect film? And maybe we could run through film because the real story is peak TV, I think, over the last 15 years, more so than the slow decline of film, which to me is a artifact of the era of mass culture, and we just don't live in an era of mass culture anymore, so it's not that big a shock that the paradigmatic medium of the 20th century is no longer what it was. People aren't gathering in movie theaters anymore, just like they're not gathering in associations anymore, et cetera, et cetera. So let's talk about film briefly, but then let's really spend time talking about how this shaped the rise of peak TV.
Sure. I would take a certain issue with that. In fact, you might be right. It might be the case that mass culture is over for the most part when it comes to just limitless opportunities for consumption and, yeah, so much niche media. However, you do have a desire for shared culture, and movies might have filled that.
The decline would have been slower. I think the difference is okay. Rate of decline.
Yeah.
I just truly think, and this is not a good thing, that we have become so alienated and atomized that mass cultural experiences are on the decline, except like going to a theme park. That's like the last mass culture in sports, you know, which is why all the media companies are investing in sports, by the way. But but I do agree the decline didn't have to be as like dramatic as it was.
I guess I could imagine a different path taken where if movie theaters and studios were not as riddled with Wall Street investment tactics, that in fact they decide, yeah, diversity, having lots of different movies is our strategy, and we're going to bring theater prices down because we want to encourage people. I mean, that movie pass moment showed that people really do want to go to theaters if it was affordable. Have a young kid, take them to the theater. It's going to cost me like $50, $60. Or I can buy one video game that will give entertainment for hours, weeks, months, right? Like the costs just do not make sense. And I would say something like Marvel, something like Minions, there are certain mass culture things. Like people do want to be part of that. They want to be part of the Taylor Swift phenomenon. They want to be...
It's not going to the movies two times a week like it was in the 40s. I mean, like, that is the context within which I operate, right?
See. Like, but that they did during MoviePass, right? That was such a weird in.
People did. Some people.
Some
did.
Young people, yeah. Though.
Yes. Right? Which agreed. Agreed.
Importantly, agreed.
It did
for
not
them.
Have to be. It was. I agree. It's just never going to be 1952 again.
Okay. But imagine. Like, imagine prices went down to $5 a ticket, and if
sure,
young people,
yeah, yeah, it, exactly. Agreed.
If young people went in throngs again, and that's how like Hollywood reinvigorated itself in the late 60s and early 70s was like appealing to young people with films that actually spoke to them, and it was an affordable thing to do. But instead, yeah, we have movie ticket prices and concert ticket prices that have just far outpaced inflation. And so you've turned that culture into something that's only available to upper middle class folks. I still maintain hope that they might change path, and that if different companies with DIP had different strategies, it might still occur. And the thing with film is, there's actually a lot of movies, way more being produced every year than there ever have been. It's just that studios are putting all their eggs into one basket. And so you have Disney making or having this tremendous market share with just a handful of films, right? So there's more films, but the actual market share and revenues come from a smaller and smaller
set. Right, and this is your great statistic that you have on the top 100. The box office produced domestically by the top 100 films has basically, today it's like 6.7%, and in the late 80s it was like in the 40s of percentages, something
like
that.
Yeah, 1988.
So maybe you could talk about the right of IP, the rise of IP rather, and how that relates to this, because I think that's the most clear thing that people would understand in their own lives.
Yeah, right. And so, yeah, to give that statistic, in 1988, not too long ago, more than 40% of theatrical U.S. box office sales were achieved with original stories. In 2019, the share of box office fell to just 6%. Meanwhile, the establishment and continuation of franchises used to occupy only about a quarter of the market, has since risen to 3/4 of the market, and then other types of adaptations account for most of the rest. So yeah, as much as I talk about the, you know, pricing strategies could have been a path, a different path taken, another would be this reliance on intellectual property. You know, there's a lot of talk about why is there so many sequels, franchises? Why this strategy? And the assumption is, well, it's less risky. And there's part of that, right? Certainly, it's easier to sell a new Batman than it is to sell a new original story. People already know what Batman is. They like it. They want more of it, apparently. So there's the idea of it being pre-sold property is one explanation. And another is like, well, it creates corporate synergy, right? If you have Batman, you can sell toys and you can have the soundtrack and you can do all these different things across your entertainment conglomerate. And that's a part of it. But I actually think it's like just raw power. Like no one else can make Batman movies except for one of those four companies. In this case, it's Warner, who has that intellectual property that is tremendously expensive. We mentioned Lord of the Rings with Amazon. If you are a big company, you want your costs to get higher in terms of budgets because no one else can do that. You form a cartel with the other companies who can and push out any new competitors. So again, their incentive is to crush competition, and IP is one way to do that. That's been a big story in Hollywood in the last 30 years. Certainly, we see it happening on television as well, right? It's less pronounced, but you look at the, like, what is it, Chicago hospital lawyers, police, and then there's, the whole Law and Order world. There is reality TV is very franchise-based, except for the franchises actually occurring around the world, right? So that you have The Voice in the US and Brazil and all around the world. There's often like dozens and dozens of versions. And so reality TV, these competition shows in particular, this is all like that franchising intellectual property model as well, except those allow a little bit of customization and localization in ways that Batman doesn't.
Yeah, so I think it might make sense now to talk about peak TV. So what made peak TV, and then why is Hollywood going through such a extended contraction right now? I mean, I know so many people who haven't worked in literal years to the degree where they're just leaving the industry. Now, granted, Hollywood is an industry that people enter and leave and has been from the beginning. I mean, this is a classic American story. So maybe we could talk about peak TV and this contraction and what's different now.
So this is another good comparison to music, right? Which is that in the early aughts, music goes through its digital transition, and that it's really competitive, or it's really like destructive at first, but ends up leading to something more like new consumer patterns. And there's lots of like competition at first with different ways in which that might happen. And then this happens later with film and TV. Once the costs of broadband come down, something like Netflix can arise. And similarly to music, where those companies were just sort of caught off guard or they were too lazy to see what was happening, the big studios were happy to license their film and TV to Netflix at first, thinking it was just another window, right? After theater and pay TV, eventually you get down to, okay, streaming channels, the last one. And so Netflix can build up this impressive catalog. It can, you know, turn Breaking Bad into a hit, which it wasn't when it was only on cable TV. But of course, you start to train customers into expecting huge catalogs of on-demand TV and film. They no longer have to wait for their episodes. You have the phenomenon of binge viewing. But you also get this sense that the studios didn't really realize what they were doing. Years later, they're all sort of on record saying, oh, we made a mistake. We actually funded our investor or our competitor by giving them cheaply licensed content. But so Netflix has this wind behind their sails, let's say, of getting this like cheaply licensed content at the same time as you're in this zero interest rate period. And so then the flood of money comes. Investors, this is the new way that people will deal with or that they'll engage with film and TV. It's taking a long time, much longer than music, right? You still have a lot of cable TV subscribers, but you have this competition, which is, called peak TV, is finally over now. For many years, it was like, I can't possibly get bigger next year. And then it did again, right? And so you have well-funded companies pouring more and more money into trying to create original content that would somehow be distinctive enough to get someone to subscribe to their service. And this run-up was great for the town and for workers and for viewers, but it was always ephemeral. There was no way it could continue. You can't just keep producing more and more television shows as the model is actually changing for the worse. Like I said, you're exchanging $100+ cable bills for $10+ streaming bills. And the only way it could work out was further consolidation. And so we're seeing that, right? Like, we used to talk about the big seven or the big eight companies, and now it's like the big four. It's Netflix, Disney, Comcast, who owns NBC Universal, and Warner. Paramount has just been sold to a private equity company and the son of a wealthy ghoul, Larry Ellison. You have, yeah, some other, you know, players who are just will not be able to compete. They will be arms dealers, as they say. They, you know, someone like Sony does well in other aspects of entertainment and does okay in film and TV, but it is going to be selling its wares to these bigger companies who will have control over the, you know, means of access, let's say, the big services. So at the same time that's all happening, you have Amazon and Apple who are dipping their toes. Like you say, it does not seem like it can be actually profitable for them in and of itself, but as part of their larger empire building strategies, it does work. So yeah, peak TV is this huge run up, and then you finally have a series of events, the pandemic, the writers and actors strike. But most importantly, it's investors saying, you know what?
Make money.
It's time for profit. You're increasing your subscribers each year is not enough for us to keep investing. We need to see profitability. And so all those companies, what do? Fire a whole bunch of people, thousands of people. Every big media company, every big tech company turned around and did that. And then we see, just far less production and far more outsourcing and things that are cheaper for them. So more, even more reality TV, even more animation, special effects driven products that can be outsourced to places that don't have unions. And you have this overall sense of decline, which has been, I think, because we went through such a like tumultuous period for so many different reasons, but going through union strike and then market correction has just left film and TV in such a dire place
right
now.
It's like decimated. Like there's almost no one working any longer. I think it's a permanent contraction. I think that the film and TV business that emerges in the next 5-10 years is going to be much, much smaller. For a diversity of reasons, for the ones that you said, also the fact that, you know, YouTube is an amazing business model. You just get a cut of everything and put nothing into production. It's hard to compete with that. And that people just spend their time watching scripted film and television a lot less. And a lot of the ancillary industries, particularly commercial production, are also going away because the second a commercial comes on, we all go to our phones. So that commercial directing and all the below the line people that supported that are also not being hired. So it just seems like the American film and TV business as a dominant form lasted about 100 years. And now it's going to be, there's going to be people who are going to be watching this stuff and there'll still be jobs in the industry. But barring some gigantic reformation in regulation, I think it's basically going to disappear to a significant degree.
Yes. The regulation aside, which apparently will be put to the side now, right, that Lena Khan is unfortunately likely to be out of a job. There was hope in that kind of regulatory change. I will say that like advertising is not going to go away either. And advertising has been the underlying mode of financing, let's say, for a lot of our stories and songs. Advertising has become more efficient. You know, Google and Facebook have, you know, the digital duopoly of advertising has replaced a lot of traditional advertising. That's a big source for why news is suffering. But we can also translate that to film and TV and music. But I think there's a case that advertising digitally is actually really ineffective. And something like the Super Bowl and those rates not only persist, but get bigger. I'm talking about like the cost of airing a commercial in the Super Bowl. Because that advertisement is like a kind of thing you can't get from digital advertising. You can't get mass culture recognition of a brand. And so maybe there is still some case where film and TV operate in a model that is run by advertisements that, yeah, I mean, Netflix, Max, Disney, they all move to advertisements on their streaming platforms pretty quickly. Not only because it's another revenue stream, but because it is it's one where you get to change the prices, right? You can, if you get a huge hit, then you can increase the cost of ads on that hit. And so I assume that, you know, as Star Wars TV shows took off, they can charge more for ads, right? And so there's still like growth opportunities there. And I'm not, let's say, totally convinced that Hollywood is over. I do think it's in decline. I do think the era, the post-war prosperity that gave birth to this dynamic industry is unlikely to return.
Once again, millennials get fucked.
I do think, and this is, you know, you can tell I'm a film studies person. I do think people love visual stories. I do think they love music. I don't think that desire goes away. It's unfortunate to see it be consumed by like short form video content, which is, yeah, largely ephemeral and doesn't have a lot of meaning or significance. But
and also all this stuff is just staffed by people who come from money, not necessarily even people within the industry, but the only way you're able to make it a career is if you have money. Well, Andrew, I think on that note, it's a good uplifting place to end. Thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, check out Derivative Media. It's actually available for free. So if you're interested in the political economy of music, film, and television, definitely check it out. We didn't even get into the part of Andrew's book, which is really insightful, where he shows how all of these financial machinations actually shape the content that you're watching, which is another really interesting story. But Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.